Hello there, Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, we've got the high flyer with us. That is, the first item that I'm going to tell you about is a strange object that visited our solar system in 2017. On November the 12th in 2018, Avi Loeb, who was then the chairman of the astronomy department at Harvard, and a young research associate, published a paper in the highly prestigious astrophysical journal, Letters, arguing that humans may have discovered the first evidence of alien technology in the form of a mysterious object called Oumuamua that had streaked through the solar system the previous fall. Reporters had flocked to their door to hear about this. And few of the colleagues of this fellow, however, were doubtful. It made a good story for the newspapers, but his scientific colleagues didn't agree with him, as Loeb will be the first to tell you in his new book called Extraterrestrial. And this is part graceful memoir and part plea for keeping an open mind about the possibilities of what is out there in the universe, in particular, life. Otherwise, he says, we might miss something amazing, like the church officials in the 17th century who refused to look through Galileo's telescope. Are we both scientists and lay people ready? He asked in his introduction. Is human civilization ready to confront what follows our accepting the plausible conclusion arrived at through evidence-backed hypotheses? The terrestrial life isn't unique, and perhaps not even particularly impressive. I fear the answer is no, and that prevailing prejudice is a cause for concern. That quote, taken from his book. Well, Oumuamua, which is Hawaiian for scout, was first noticed by a telescope on the island of Maui on October 19th, 2017, when it was already on its way out of the solar system, having passed closest to the sun a month before. It had come from outside the solar system from the direction of the star Vega. No one ever got a picture of the object, but from how its brightness varied as it apparently tumbled, astrophysicists were able to deduce that it was about a quarter mile across and at least 5 to 10 times longer than it was wide. An artist's interpretation of reddish cigar-shaped rock was widely reproduced, based on some surprising herky-jerky motions as it departed our realm. Astronomers concluded that Oumuamua was a weird comet. Such objects often get accelerated by jets of evaporating gases on their surface, although in this case, no evaporating gases were detected. But Loeb argues that it is no more preposterous to suppose that Oumuamua was a light sail, that is, a thin material that gets its propulsive boost from sunlight or starlight, either launched in our direction or anchored like a buoy in space, where we ran into it on our planet's travel around the galaxy. In which case, the age-old question, are we alone in the universe, has been answered. Well, it is fair to say that Loeb, who was raised with a philosophical bent on a farm in Israel, the son of refugees from the Holocaust and war-torn Europe, is one of the more imaginative and articulate scientists around. Central to his argument is what he calls the Oumuamua wager, a takeoff on Pascal's famous wager that the upside of believing in God far outweighs the downside. Likewise, believing that Oumuamua could have been an alien spacecraft can only make us more alert and receptive to thinking outside the box. As Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind. As he writes toward the end of this half memoir, half soaring monologue, quote, "But the moment we know that we are not alone, that we are almost certainly not the most advanced civilization ever to have existed in the cosmos, we will realize that we've spent more funds developing the means to destroy all life on the planet than it would have cost to preserve it." Mull that over for a while, and I'll be right back in a minute or two. We're back again, and I'd like to tell you about a provocative book that came out just recently. It's by Judith Flanders, the author of A Place for Everything. Alphabetical order may seem an inevitable way to organize the world, as natural as A before B. But we weren't destined to sort things in this familiar way. According to British historian Judith Flanders in her new book. So I'm going to tell you just a bit about her new book. And first of all, what are the other ways that humans could have ordered things? And she responds, "We still use many today, but they are all strangely invisible. When schools organize their students by classes, they are using chronology or age for the grades first, then alphabetical order. Bookshops divide up their books by subject first, fiction, nonfiction, then history, travel, and only then alphabetically. You can file chronologically. If you just pile papers in a basket, the oldest will be on the bottom. Or historically, records were frequently kept hierarchically with the most important people or things at the beginning." And then she was asked, "How did alphabetical order become the standard?" The answer, "The key element to the success of alphabetical order is that the searcher doesn't need any preliminary knowledge. If you were using geographical order, say, to list all the states, west to east, or north to south, You'd either have to go through almost every state before you got to Florida, or you'd have to have a pretty good idea of where it was to begin with. With alphabetical order, all you need to know is that it begins with F. Well, she was asked, will alphabetical order be with us forever? And her reply was, if we think about alphabetical order at all, and we rarely do, we think of it as if it were a sort of alphabetical Stonehenge, something that has always and will always exist. With increasing online hyperlinks and search functions, I suspect that in the next half century or so, we may have to explain it again. An alphabetical order, instead of being eternal, will simply have turned out to be a historical quirk. An 8th-century-long quirk. True, but a quirk nonetheless. Are you ready for GameStop mania? A Wall Street tug of war. For a brief time over the past several weeks, a bunch of amateur traders made Wall Street's finest look like idiots. That according to the Wall Street Journal. A ragtag army of individuals exchanging tips in online forums like Reddit's Wall Street Bets, bought up shares in the video game retailer GameStop, and the stock went from $40 to as much as $400 in just a few days, before falling back down to about $95. Hedge funds on the other side of these bets lost billions. Trading in GameStop shares was so frantic that leading online brokerage firms restricted buy orders for some of this month's hottest stocks. That created a wave of populist anger and bipartisan calls for an investigation of whether brokerages favor big funds over small investors. Still, the victory for a flash mob of small investors was a remarkable moment in the democratization of markets, even if it was only to be short-lived. Step aside, Wall Street, according to Amber Petrovich in the Washington Post. I taught myself about investing 15 years ago. Now I'm part of a new class of investors who can move markets in just a few clicks. Yes, some of us may get hurt if GameStop continues to fall, but that's the risk of inventing that we chose to run. And then there's this comment from Bloomberg.com. Day traders have long nursed anger at Wall Street elites, and now they've focused it on short-selling funds that bet against companies like GameStop. When hedge funds sell short, they sell borrowed shares of companies they believe will fall in value. Short sellers can get squeezed and forced to buy shares at an inflated price, as happened with GameStop. If speculators gang together to bid up a company's stock, generally though, short sellers expect their target's price to fall because they see deep problems with the business. A sudden buying frenzy doesn't remedy those. Remember Enron? It could do no wrong, until Jim Chanos called it a ruse. Another short seller, Jeffrey Citrin, exposed the fraud at Valent Pharmaceuticals in the fall of 2015. And investors who paid attention to him saved a lot of money. Online traders accused short sellers of spreading negative news for their own benefit. That, according to BreakingNews.com, the writer was John Foley. But market manipulation is just as unhealthy when it works in the other direction. The mavens who urged you to buy GameStop shares don't care what happens to the company over time. They just need the shares to go up for long enough to cash in. So be careful out there where you put your money. And now, a short break. Enjoy the music. Our pandemic that we've been experiencing for the past year has brought a great deal of change to society, to our economy. Things will never be the same again. So don't be upset when you see that changes that have taken place over the past year. Don't disappear. I wanted to give you some information about changing cities in that regard. From Boston, Massachusetts, to Barcelona in Spain, to Bogota in Colombia, and Seoul in South Korea, cities around the world have responded to the pandemic with an accelerated taking back of the streets from cars and returning those streets to pedestrians and cyclists. Although some of these moves were declared to be temporary, they have faced very little pushback. And the sense is that once the world's cities reemerge from a new wave of pandemic lockdowns, many of the changes will be here to stay, forever altering the urban landscapes and lifestyles that we knew before. Urban planners are exploring other innovations that are more unconventional and far-reaching, seizing on the moment to redesign how people use space. They are looking at such things as turning suddenly empty office buildings into badly needed residential spaces, and rezoning so that work and leisure and school can be within easy reach, creating self-contained neighborhoods that are their own 15-minute cities, and reimagining park space to link long isolated neighborhoods. The changes that are going on in cities today continue to change in response to the virus. And many people are worried that the new initiatives could benefit some residents over others, and making worse social and economic inequalities. Questions swirl, for example, about which populations will be served by the new bike lanes, the pedestrian areas, and the space for sidewalk cafes. The affluent or low income. Throughout history, cities have survived wars, natural disasters, and plagues, and often have come through better at the end of them. Now, planners say the pandemic offers an opportunity for urban areas around the world to reinvent themselves in a way that transforms both the sociology and the livability of cities. Start taking cities back from cars. Start developing a new set of expectations. That's what we need to do, according to Elihu Rubin, who is a professor of urbanism at Yale University School of Architecture. This is the power the built environment has to shape our expectations. It can be a driver of racism and segregation, but it can also be our savior as it begins to suggest new modes of urban living. And so, leave with this thought today, that cities throughout history have survived wars and plagues and often come through stronger. But now, there are some people who believe that the pandemic will yield innovations that will make cities street-friendly, more user-friendly for residents, and give neighborhoods a greater voice in planning. So if you'd like to read this article in its entirety, you want to look at the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, January 4th and 7th, 2021. We're going to finish today with some global news. Most of this is about the fishing industry. The people who have fish as a part of their culture and also of their economy. In the United States, for the first time in 80 years, Chinook salmon have spawned in the Upper Columbia River system in the Pacific Northwest. The construction of massive dams in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s blocked the migratory fish from returning to habitat. But indigenous communities and scientists have been working for years to bring the salmon back. And the discovery is a major milestone for the reintroduction of the species and a moment of hope for local tribes whose history is intertwined with the river system and with the salmon. And then, while we're out in the Pacific Northwest, we can go north a bit to the island of Vancouver in Canada, where the Songhees Nation and researchers from the University of Victoria have created the first scientific catalog of wildlife around the archipelago of the Tsleil-Waututh, establishing a baseline for future conservation efforts. Known to non-Indigenous Canadians as the Discovery and Chatham Islands, this area is the last place of undeveloped land in the Songhees territory. The islands have been uninhabited by the First Nation members since the 1950s. In lieu of more expensive and time-consuming survey methods, researchers have used an underwater drone to find several species the Songhees leaders identified as important to their ceremonial, their social, and harvest traditions. And finally, we go to the island of Mozambique, where a new fisheries law opens the door for communities to help protect a broader range of marine species and develop more sustainable practices. So all three of these items of global news are about the environment and fishing. Now, my friends, it looks like there's very little time for us to continue. And so, until next time, this is Dan Dillman asking you, be safe out there. Wear your mask. Please practice social distancing. It helps us all. I want you to have a good day, my friends. Be sure to come back. Listen to us next time. When 101.5 brings you a little of this, a little of that. Like to have you around, so don't stay away. I'll be here waiting for you. Good day.